Okay, so as we turn to the story of Esther, there are throughout history, some may have even recalled, may have even heard some of these stories of there being, there's only one Esrog in the town, there is an Esrog far, far away. The other of the Dalet Minim, when it comes to Sukkot, the other Dalet Minim, it's not so specific as to what it is. And not only that, those branches, a lulav, palm trees, could be found throughout the world. Aravos can be found. Did anybody here have, I have an Aravos bush in my backyard that my the landlord put in once upon a time. Maybe else here have Aravos bushes? May have heard about them. There are people in town. Our entire shul gets their Aravos on Hoshana Rabbah from one of the members of the shul, have a big bush, and that's how Aravos are taken care of. Hadassim also are not so hard to come by. Esrogim are very hard to come by. Anybody know why Esrogim cost $50? $75 for like a fruit? Anybody ever like wonder about that?
They stay on the tree for like 7 years or something.
Well, they don't have to. They could be plucked off. That is actually one of very good. That's one of the simanim of a esrog. We'll get to that in shortly. But why do they cost so much?
Not so commonly found.
They need a specific climate. The real reason is because people are willing to pay for it. That's the real reason. So rules of supply and demand, and those are the prices, and that's just the way it is. I did look into it a couple. I used to get very upset about shmur matzah costing $30 a pound for like the equivalent of a loaf of bread, and the esrogim costing as much as they do. I found out that esrogim are kind of hard to get going. I mean, once you get an esrog farm going, it produces nicely, and you can make a lot of money off of it. But you are at strong risk of not making any money off of it, of not being able to produce any good esrogim going forward. And they only grow in specific climates. So most of our esrogim that come to this country come from Eretz Yisrael. They come from Italy. They come from Egypt. When I lived in Phoenix, Arizona, before moving to Philadelphia, there were attempts there at starting an esrog farm. I don't think anything ever came of it. And we'll see in a little bit about the Caribbean esrogim. So they do come from pretty far away, and that kind of drives up the price of the esrogim. Yeah?
Like originating from Greece?
Well, so we assume, I don't know where they originated from, or our version, they are indigenous to this hemisphere, as we're going to see. Okay? So, very quick, source number one is just the Gemara that tells us about an esrog. Tanu Rabban pre Eitz Hadar. So what does the Gemara tell us? Masechta Sukkah, Eitz Shetam Eitzo Upirio Shava. So Havi Omer is a esrog. It is a esrog. It is a fruit where the fruit and the tree taste the same. I don't know what that means. I don't know what that means. The bark, the branch, I'm not sure what that means. I don't know how it works. Esrogim don't generally taste very good. If you ever have esrog jam, or you ever have esrog liquor, those kinds of things, it only tastes somewhat decent because you have a little bit of esrog and a ton of sugar that is added in on top of it, right? It's like worse than a lemon, and there's not much flesh. And if you ever pull an esrog apart, you're not going to see very much flesh inside of it. But one of the unique thing is somehow the tree and the fruit taste the same. That probably tells you more about the fruit than it does about the tree. Rebbe Omer, Al Tiki Hadar Ela Hadir. Rather, it's like the deer. What is the deer? A deer is like a pen. If you ever learned Maseches Bava Metzia, important topic in the first parak there. So Hadar... So Adri Hadar El Hadir Madir Ze Yeshbo Gadol Vekatanim, that in every pen, when you have a pen of animals, many different sheep there, you have big animals, small animals, Tamimim Vali Mumin, you have animals that have mums, you have animals that don't, right? You have a large mixture. So too with Esrogim, you have big ones, little ones, mum ones, and very, very nice ones. So Gemara says, okay, what's the big deal? You can open up an apple box, and you'll see the same thing with apples. Apples also have big ones, little ones, and different sized ones. He says, no, that's different, because with the esrogim, I think this is what you're mentioning before, atu sharpeus leispu gedolim v'ketanim tamim so el ha'chi kamar at shabayin ketanim adayim gedolim kayamim. That when the small esrogim come onto the tree, did we learn luf ha'gazel when we together? So when we learned this Gemara, right? When a small esrog comes on, the previous year's esrogim are still on the tree. And that is a unique characteristic of esrogim, that the fruit stays on the tree from year to year. And the Gemara points out and says, aha! Right? You see that? You will see that that will be an esrog. He gives one more idea on it as well, that it can grow on every type of water. That doesn't need this, but it could grow on from well water or rainwater, and that's another unique characteristic of an esrog. There are other unique characteristics of an esrog as well. One more? Anybody know one other unique characteristic of an esrog? Has anybody ever saved their esrog for like a year?
It shrinks.
Have you ever tried saving an apple for a year? No, right? What happens to an apple after, like, it rots, right? So an esrog is unique in that it doesn't rot, it shrinks. So after Sukkot, I usually just lay the esrog on top of it in my office someplace, and the room smells really nice for a couple of days, I guess, until it runs out. Now I have several children who have esrogim also. We have like a nice array of the last 10 years of esrogim are laid out on top of a shelf in my office someplace, right? So that is another unique characteristic of esrog. What did you want to say?
What is the word for esrog in English?
Citron is the way it's translated. It's a proper noun, so it's hard to know what is a great proper.
They call it citrus.
Even if you want to go into a unique store and say, "Hey, can I?" I don't. I think it's known as a citron. I don't know what is the technical term. We'll get into. Oh, it's not on this. It's not on this source sheet. There is a little bit of a discussion about what should be the name be, but it didn't make it this year because we only have 45 minutes. You want to say something, Yuda?
Do you know why it is that it shrinks and dries out as opposed to rotting?
I don't know. I feel like because there's not much flesh inside of it. That would be my guess, but it's a miracle. It's amazing, which actually brought about several shilas that I didn't put on the sheet. But one issue question was, because it was so hard in Europe, if you live in Northern Europe, so how are you going to get an esrog? Right? So you can call someone up in Italy. The problem is you don't have a phone. Right? They could try to mail it to you. There's no mail. Right? There is no great way of getting an esrog. Certainly no good way of getting an esrog that would provide for an entire community. So when I look out over my shul on Sukkot and I see the entire shul raising a esrogim up, right? Meet ladies who love them up, and you see everyone holding a esrogim that did not exist for centuries upon centuries of the Jewish people, right? We read in the, if those have learned Mishnah Sukkah, it talks about that everyone came to the base of Migdash with their dalad minim and they had to figure out a way to store them. That was not the case if you lived in Europe. If you lived in Europe for the last 1,000 years or so, up to now, up to the last couple of decades, it was very difficult to procure the dalad minim and particularly an esrog over the course of Sukkot. So one of the questions was, can we get a esrog and save it for next year? Right? We'll just save it, and it doesn't look bad, it doesn't rot, can we save it for next year? So there is a disqualification of all dalad minim. Those that learned Luluf HaGazel once upon a time, do you remember, there is a disqualification that will keep you away that? It's dried out, right. One of the prohibitions is yavesh. If it is yavesh, it's no good. So that was not acceptable. There is actually a tshuva of the Truma Sedeshin, where he suggests that there was a community that actually cut it up, because there were so few, so a community cut it up into four pieces and sent it to four different communities. Can we use a piece of an esrog? He suggests maybe you could use a piece when it's fresh, but not when it's dry. That was one of the discussions that took place. Another interesting idea, how many people here, when you're in high school, if you make it to Minyan, here Minyan is what, 8:30, something like that? Down late, 7:55, oh, okay. Right, so people, I daven 6:40, 6:30 every morning. You get into the issue of half the year, almost, not half the year, about a third of the year, it's actually before sunrise. We daven Shacharis before sunrise. So you learn Mishnayos Brachos. What is the time? Right? Shavuos morning, when do we wait till daven on Shavuos morning? We wait for Vasikin. What is Vasikin? Neitzachama, when the sun comes up. So how do we daven, and most shuls in America during the winter, daven before sunrise? So how could you daven before sunrise if the Mishnah says you have to wait till sunrise? Anybody ever think about that? Why do shuls permit that? Why do shuls permit it? So there is a tshuva here. It's source number 3, the Stei Chemet. The Stei Chemet is a type of encyclopedia that was written before there were computers, which is pretty amazing. He goes actually in alphabetical order of topics. One of the things he covers is Zman. And he actually quotes here from the Aderet. Anybody know who ever heard of the Aderet? Rav Avram, David, excuse me, it's right there. Eliyahu David Rabinowitz Teumim. He was the Rav in Mir. Right, you've heard of the Mir Yeshiva in Yerushalayim. So there was a town called Mir. He was the rabbi of the town of Mir. Ultimately made his way to Eretz Yisrael. He had a very famous son-in-law that you definitely have heard of if you go to Kohelet, Rav Kook. He was Rav Kook's father-in-law, the Aderet. He, interestingly, when he left Mir, he moved to Yerushalayim because there was a rabbi there, Rav Shmuel Salant, who was the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, and he was getting kind of old. He was, I think, entering his, I think he was going to turn 80 soon. I think that's the age. So they hired the Adaret, who was the young age of 55, 60, to be the assistant rabbi and ultimately, eventually, take over for Shmuel Salant. So what happened? The Adaret died about 10, 15 years later. Shmuel Salant was still alive, still doing fine. So he ended up never taking over as the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. On his tombstone, on Har Zeisim, it says, again, Eliyahu David Rabinowitz Umim Shenimnu, that was chosen to be the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, even though he never got it, right? Got chosen to be. All right. So anyway, so he writes that in his town, in Mir, there is one Esrog in town. How is everybody, and you know how many Jews there were in Mir? That's one of the towns where there are a lot. Like, a lot of Jews. Thousands of people. How is everybody going to have a chance to bench Lulav and Esrog in the town of Mir? So what do they do? We're going to have one Lulav and Esrog in the central city, in central shul, and one by one, people would come in, they'd pick, you know, they'd make the bracha, shake it, and then move on. But there's not going to be enough time in the day for everyone in Mir to have a chance to do that. So what are they going to do? We're going to expand the time all the way to Alos HaShachar, all the way to dawn, rather than wait till sunrise. How could you do that? The Mishnah says you can't do any of these things before Netzachama. It's a clear Mishnah. What's his answer? He says, look up, there's a clock in the room. So there's a clock. The whole fear of waiting till sunrise is because if you don't, because we might be confused, it might not really be light enough. You don't really know what it is. There's an issue in Yuma about that they thought it was daytime, but really wasn't daytime yet. It was really just the moon was shining bright. But if you have a clock, it will be okay. So having the clock actually seemed to change the din a little bit, which is a little bit. How can you go ahead and do that? Another question is Rav David Frankel here. Another issue that came up. Rav David Frankel had the shaila of, let's say your town does not have an esrog, but you hear the next town over does. Are you obligated to go to the next town over and spend sukkahs your next town over so that you'll have an opportunity to lulav and esrog? What do we think? What? Who thinks that you would have to go? Nobody? Who thinks that you would? Oh, we got one. Who thinks that you wouldn't? Right, so why would you not? There's a mitzvah town over. Why would you not? Why would you think you wouldn't have to go?
I would think that if everyone had to go, there would be
people in the other town.
Let's say there would be time. Let's say there would be time. See, he says because they wouldn't even think that. He figured the question was the men will go and the women will stay home. Well, then what's going to be? What kind of Simchas Yontov is it if the man leaves and the woman is left with the kids at home? So that was the way it was set up. He says you also have a mitzvah of Simchas Yontov. We're going to make everybody schlep, go to the other city. You're going to miss out on that mitzvah. So, all right. So you're going to get Esther, but you're going to lose out on Simchas Yontov. So that was his shoot. But now I want to get to. Still have moving. Okay, so I want to go to two places where we probably don't think about as being a source of halachic challenge. I shouldn't say challenge, of halachic controversy. One of them is about 5 miles downtown, Philadelphia, Mikveh Israel. How many people here have ever been to the Shul Mikveh Israel? You raise your hand like you daven there. You're going there for Yom Kippur. Okay, Mikveh Israel is the second oldest. Turo is the oldest building, right? That's what Newport, Rhode Island is the oldest building. The longest continuous shul is Sheirith Israel in New York. No?
Yeah,
what are they?
I think it's Mikveh Israel, I'm not sure.
So Mikveh Israel second, that's what they claim? Okay. So that makes sense. So we're going to go, where are we going now? 180 years ago or so. Well, we're going to go to the year 1847. 1847 now. 1847, anybody know who the rabbi was of Mikveh Israel? There was no rabbi of Mikveh Israel. There was somebody named, we'll talk about the first rabbi in America in a second, but there was somebody named Isaac Leeser. Isaac Leeser was born in Europe, came to Richmond around the year 1825 or so, worked a couple of jobs, and started writing, actually had a little bit of yeshiva training, and started writing a little bit in defense of Judaism in America. Now, how many Jews were there in America at the time? I don't know. A few thousand, maybe 3,000, 4,000, or 5,000, right? Probably much less than appear just in Lower Merion, right? There weren't too many Jews in the entire country at the time, but there were Jews that came. And also considering at the time, nowadays we sort of divide Orthodox, Conservative, Reform. There was a mix still. Now, Reform existed, but there was like a fight of like who's going to carry the day, Orthodox or Reform? There wasn't Conservative yet. But who's going to carry the day? And everybody actually had conversations with one another. So Isaac Leiser, this fellow, got the job as reverend, not as the rabbi, but as reverend of Mikveh Israel. And he also had something very handy. He had access to a printing press and started publishing. Isaac Leiser wrote the very first translation of the Chumash in America into English. I'm not sure into English, but certainly in America. He wrote the first translation in America of the Chumash, 5 volumes. Still, you could track it down today in various places. And he also wrote most of the time monthly, at times it even became a weekly, magazine called The Occident. I don't know why it was called The Occident. I don't know what that means. I tried looking into it this afternoon, didn't see. But he wrote a monthly thing called The Occident. He sent out all over the country to all Jews all over the country. So there were big, where anybody else know where there were big communities in America in the 1840s, 1850s? What? I don't know what there was in Boston. I've never seen, it could be, but I've never seen anything from Boston. But you have New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Charleston, South Carolina had a community. Savannah, Georgia. There was a synagogue in Savannah, Georgia at the time. Probably 1840 already, you might go inland a little bit. Pittsburgh, Detroit, that might have also had places, but not too many things around. This was like the main way that people could communicate in the country. How many rabbis were there in the country at that time? I don't know, not too many. The person who is credited with being the first rabbi to come to America to be a rabbi in America, right? There were rabbis who might have come to raise money. There are recordings. If you actually, how many people have been to the museum downtown, the Museum of American Jewish History, right? There is a Sefer Torah there on display that somebody had here at that period where there's a description they tracked out about him trying to get it fixed, and there happened to be someone in the country that could get it fixed. There is all shilas about people writing gittin and things like that. But the first person who came to America to be a rabbi in America was somebody by the name of Rav Avraham Reis. Rav Avraham Reis, his picture is at the bottom of the page. He is a musmach of someone named Rav Bing, who was a rav in Germany, a dayan in Germany. He was in yeshiva with people like Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, Rabbi Nathan Adler. Rabbi Nathan Adler became chief rabbi of England eventually. All right, so he came to America. I'm going to become a rav here, rabbi in America. So he writes a letter to the Occident. He's one of 2, 3, 4 rabbis in the country. He writes a letter. Sukkot time is coming. What are we going to do about Esrogim? And he writes, "My dear sir," right, Baltimore, 20th of April, 5607. That is actually what it says on the letter, which is an interesting way of dating it, right? He had the English month and day, but the Hebrew year. "But my dear sir, it is not long since several of my friends urged me to come out publicly in your periodical with my opinion about the Esrogim, which are yearly brought from the West Indies to this country. I am so much disinclined to give publicity to anything of the controversial nature matters of religion," right? "I don't like getting involved in machlekes," but you still hear people talking about it like that today, "that even now I should not trouble you, but that the time is approaching when our yearly communications are made to the West Indies for the supply of citrons." When are they writing it? They said, this is the time of year when we write to the West Indies about sending us citrons, right? What was the date?
April,
right? 6 months until the right, but you got to write a letter, they got to collect it, they got to send it back, right? So we're writing, right? So, and I think there's therefore my duty for the sake of our religion to state that these esrogim are kosher, and they cannot be found any word against them in all of the poskim arishonim v'achronim. All to promote the unity of Israel and matters of religious aversion, all rumors that were set afloat against the kosher of the esrogim are founded in error and misinformation. I realize there's 5 rabbis in the whole country, and there's machlekes about whether it's kosher or not, right, are found to be false, and endeavor to affect our, my dear sir, I wish only to promote the unity of Israel in matters of religion, observance, endeavor to affect of our brethren of Israel, shall not be willfully deprived to the observance of mitzvahs lulav without just cause. I remain very respectfully your obedient servant, Avraham Reis. Right, so he has a letter writing, saying these esrogim that are in the West Indies, they're good. Why would I have thought they wouldn't be good? Okay, well, they don't have to be from Israel. There's no halacha they have to be from Israel. Why would I think they wouldn't be good? They're a different region, and it seems because there is another tshuva. Turn to the back of the page. Rabbi Eliyahu Posek, who is still in Hungary, but he has a tshuva about the Esrogs in America. It seems, right, that not only did they ask the rabbis in America, but the tshuva was sent. Someone wrote a letter to Europe saying, hey, we have these Esrogim, or these things that look like Esrogim, but apparently they looked a little different than the Esrogim that they were used to. And that was the Shaila. Right, they look like Esrogim, they smell like Esrogim, that they're a little different than Esrogim. Are they going to be acceptable? It says, Uvetshuvas divi Rabbi Yossi for Isi L'inyan Esrogi America, Hanikrim Esrogim, what's that next word? No. Nikrim Esroge on the third line. West Indi, right? The West Indi Esrogim, Shemishunim Ktsas Bitorim Mishalano, that they look a little bit different than our Esrogim. Shekakar Vachashav Shehim Esroge Amitim, Shehotzim Teva Arts Belitach Bolas Adam, Shenimsim Biuri Yime Kedim, Shegedolim Heim Achav, etc. And he goes on and says, it seems to me that those are better Esrogim. Why would those be better Esrogim? Because our Esrogim that we've been successful in growing in a couple of places in Europe or Southern Europe and they're able to send around, those have traveled around, and those risk becoming a morkav. Anybody know what a morkav is? Morkav is when it gets mixed with another species. He says, our esrogim, they've been played around with. Those esrogim that are sitting in the Caribbean and nobody worried about using them for a mitzvah for many, many years, those are actually the original esrogim. I think those are the esrogim that they had in Gan Eden. That's what he writes, and he continues later on. Those are the real esrogim. Ours are a little bit perhaps problematic. Those are good esrogim to use. That was the psak from Rabbi Eliyahu Posek. That was the psak from Rabbi Rice. Did anybody disagree? This is another rabbi you probably never heard of, by the name of Bezalel Illuei. Bezalel Illuei, another fascinating person. He was a rav. He was a Talmud of the Chassam Sofer. We've all heard of the Chassam Sofer, right? He was a Talmud of the Chassam Sofer. Came to America to be a rabbi. And if you look, anybody ever use the website HebrewBooks.org? As you get older, hopefully you'll get. You've heard of this? HebrewBooks.org was originally, people don't think it's just a collection of svarim. It was originally put together to collect svarim that were rare in America. Right, it was like old American Sfarim were put, because there were a lot of Talmidei Chachamim that came to America in the early 1900s. They're running away from Europe. They were brilliant, brilliant people who wrote volumes and volumes of responsa, and they're the rabbis in the middle of nowhere. So this was the Omaha and Fargo in the middle of Minnesota someplace, right? So we're going to collect all of those things and put them in a database that people are going to be able to use. So there is a sefer on the in Hebrew Books by this Rabbi Bezalel. It's about Rabbi Bezalel Illuei and a collection of some of his psakim, a collection of some of his ideas, about 150 pages. I printed it out once and read through a bunch of it, right? It takes you to another world. Rabbi Bezalel Illuei was, just a fascinating side note, he was a rabbi in Baltimore. And around this time of year, around this time, it was right. There was something called the Civil War, right? Remember, you ever heard of this? We all heard of the Civil War, right? To the rabbi in Baltimore, is Maryland a free state or a slave state? Anybody know?
Free state.
What? Maryland was a free state, but they joined the Union, but it was nervous. It was touch and go whether they would be. It was very controversial whether Maryland should be a free state or whether it should be a slave state. Rabbi Bezalel Illuei, and there is a collection of different sermons. Let's go like this. Who is the rabbi? Who is not the rabbi? The president before Abraham Lincoln?
Buchanan.
Very good. Okay. Buchanan. I believe it was Buchanan. You're right? You're sure? Okay. Buchanan lost his election, right? Lincoln was elected in November. Lincoln doesn't become president until when?
March,
right? So there's a couple months there. Buchanan sees the government falling apart, right? The nation is splitting, falling down apart. He actually called, I forget the date, I think December 20th, a day in December, maybe it was early January, declared it a day of fasting and supplications to God. Right? Declared in America. Can you imagine this? Can you imagine Donald Trump announcing it's going to be a day of fasting for the entire country? He declared a day of fasting for the hope of preserving the Union, and people observed this. And even shuls had this. So Sheirith Israel and this shul in Baltimore that we'll get to in a second. So rabbis got up and spoke about their position about the Union and about slavery, about the Civil War. So they're actually different. We actually could see what rabbis thought about slavery in the country. So Rabbi Tzal Ilway gave a fiery drasha in Maryland about, I remember, he's the Orthodox Talmud of the Chasam Sofer, Chadash Aser Min HaTorah, and what is clear from the Torah? That the Torah has some kind of status of being a slave. So he says, how could you say slavery is immoral if the Torah talks about having slaves? Right? That was Rabbi Tzal. He gave this drush in Baltimore. Didn't go very well. People were not happy with him. He had to leave town and became the rabbi of, at that time, was actually a much larger community in New Orleans. He traveled all the way to New Orleans, where they were very happy to have a pro-slavery Orthodox rabbi on their hand. Made his way to New Orleans, became the rabbi of New Orleans for many years. That is some of the story of Rabbi Tzal Ilway. So he has a couple of tshuvos that are in this English collection of his stuff. So you can see here, number one, what's here is number 8. Would not permit the bringing of the dead into the synagogue to hold funeral services there, right? Still a major issue out of Yom Hazeh. Okay. Another temporary issue. In the year 1861, the first year of his ministry in New Orleans. Interesting, right? 1961. 1960 is when this happens, and he runs away. Now it's 1961. It was impossible, owing to all communications with northern cities being cut off, to obtain esrogim. Sukkot comes along in New Orleans. Where are we going to get our esrog shipment from? Ulav v'adasim arinacha were to be had in abundance, being native to the soil, but not esrogim. The esrog that grew indigenously was found to be pasul. Now, what is that esrog that is growing indigenously? What is he talking about? So it's unclear. I came across this in an article quoting him as being a machlokas with Rabbi Rice, saying the West Indies one is no good. It's unclear. It could be talking about something growing in New Orleans, and what they couldn't get were the West Indies esrogim. Right, it's a little unclear what he's referring to. Right, in the emergency, my father decided they should be used, but without the usual bracha al tilas alufim. Everybody could keep them, but you could have them, but we're not going to make a bracha on them because of the suffix. Right? You can look at the other psak that he has here about a woman who had to drive to shul. Right? That's what this one is about. Cut the street to the shul. It was a fashion. Right? He mattered this woman to take a streetcar, to take a trolley to shul on Shabbos. That's another fascinating thing. Full of fascinating things in his book, Rabbi Tzal Ilway. I think he actually is buried in Cincinnati. Right? Rabbi Rice, by the way, his shul still stands. His shul, if you go to Baltimore, ever been to Inner Harbor in Baltimore? You've heard about there used to be an ESPN zone there. There's, right? So about 3 blocks away from there is something called the Lloyd Street Synagogue. The Lloyd Street Synagogue was Rabbi Rice's shul until it became Reform. Then there was a shul that was built next door called Beth Israel. Beth Israel still exists today. It's an Orthodox shul in downtown Baltimore, right? Which was built around the same time as competition. There are 2 shuls right next to each other. You can go today. One of them is an operating shul. One of them is a museum. The oldest known mikveh in the United States is in the basement of that shul. It's still a mikveh. It still actually works as a collection of water. Not used anymore, but that is in Baltimore. Fascinating place to go. Okay, one other story here to share. We're going to go, rather than America in the 1850s, we'll go to Shanghai in the early 1940s. So, anyone know anything about Jewish life in Shanghai in the early 1940s? Nothing for me? Have you ever heard of the Mir Yeshiva going to Shanghai? You've heard that story? Okay, Shanghai is an interesting place. Because Shanghai was technically, I think it was known as being an international city. I forget all the details about what its status was, but it ended up being that it wasn't really under Chinese control. It was sort of like a transit city that you can get to without a full visa. So, any Elkins Park people here? No. Rabbi Brisman's daughter is running a museum in New York where they happen to be doing a big exhibit about the Shanghai Jews. Shanghai, because of after Kristallnacht, a couple hundred Jews from Germany said, "We're getting out of here." They ended up taking boats to Shanghai. A year or two later, Jews from Lithuania long details about why this happened. There were Jews from Lithuania that were able to get visas to take them across Siberia, right, across Russia, and get to Japan. And then from Japan, once Pearl Harbor happened, so now Germany and Japan are on the same team, Germany says to Japan, we don't like you having all these Jews around. So they sent these Jews to Shanghai. Amongst those Jews were several hundred yeshiva students, mostly from the Mir Yeshiva in Lithuania. So that's known as the Mir in Shanghai. Chaim Shmulevitz was there. Rabbi Brisman's father was there. His father was there. Significant Torah personalities that found themselves in Shanghai. Many interesting things about, there was a shul that was built there by somebody for no reason in the town, place of town where nobody was living, like 30 years earlier. That ended up being used for the yeshiva. It was not simple, but they lived there as Orthodox Jews for many years. Now, there are Jews all over the world always, right? Besides nowadays with there being a Chabad house everywhere, there were Jews actually in Shanghai before all these Europeans showed up. Why would there be Jews in Shanghai before these Europeans showed up? They came via Iraq. There were Jews in Iraq. From Iraq, there's trading routes. They ended up in India. Some ended up in Shanghai. There was a family known as the Abraham family. The Abraham family was a prominent family involved in trade. They wound up in Shanghai, I think in the early 1900s, built a house there. And them being a Orthodox family, actually brought with them, as the book tells us, brought with them a goat so that they would be able to have milk, and they brought with them an esrog tree and planted an esrog tree in their backyard on their estate in the middle of Shanghai. And they lived there for a couple of years. And that's the story here in number 8, right? They lived there. Their joy lasts only until Pearl Harbor when Mr. David Hammond and all the members of his family all of a sudden these yeshiva students start showing up, or these people from Europe start showing up, and Sukkos comes along and says, no problem, I got all these esrogim on this tree here, right? We'll be able to celebrate Sukkos together. Pearl Harbor happens. Them being British citizens, they actually get arrested. The Abraham family gets arrested. Their house is seized, and actually be seized by the Nazis in Shanghai. The Nazis took over their house. It became like the Nazi consulate or the Nazi office in Shanghai. So you have a Nazi office in Shanghai that has in the backyard what? An esrog tree, right? And it's just there. And another year goes around. And now it's Sukkot time again. And the Jews know that there is this esrog tree in the middle of the backyard. So what do they do? And this is related here in the story Operation Torah Rescue, which is about this Jews. A little not so accurate. I found out some of the details a little bit more. So what do the Jews do? They go to a Chinese guy and say, hey, we'll pay you $10 if you jump the fence and bring back esrogim. And he does. He jumps the fence, brings back esrogim, and they have esrogim for that year. Now, can anybody just think about it for a second? Those that have learned this, the parak lulav hagazel, can anybody think of a problem that might exist with those esrogim? Right, they're esrog hagazel, right? They are stolen esrogim. Or are they? I mean, it was his land. He was kicked out of the land I don't want to say illegally, but because it was taken over, but unlawfully. We do have a rule that's actually talked about there that your land belongs to you and you can't give it up by force. Right? So that was a bit of the shaila, but they were okay with those esrogim. So for that year, I think 1941, they had esrogim. Now the Nazis find out that all these Jews just took esrogim right out of our backyard, literally. So what do? So the way the story is told here is that they uprooted the esrog tree, right? So no more esrog tree for 1942. Now, I know some of the details here that aren't necessarily in the book, because you see the name here, David Abraham, and Mr. David Abraham and all members of his family being British subjects, etc. He was the owner of his house. His great-grandson happens to be a member of my shul. And his name also happens to be David Abraham. Right? He's named after his great-grandfather. So he filled in some of the details for me. Over Shabbos, and that's what happened, right? So his family ended up leaving. They ended up coming to America. That's the story. But now we have these Jews. You have these yeshiva students living still in the middle of Shanghai. And the next year comes around. What are we going to do for esrogim this year? So they send out an expedition to Western China, right? The Eastern China, Shanghai is all the way on the East Coast, the Pacific Ocean. They're sending people all over the country. They're trying to like describe to like these Japanese people, like we want an Esther, like what's that? A Citron, what's that? Right? They have trouble finding it. Ultimately, they find something that looks like an Esther oak, and that is what you see here on your page. Now, does that look like an Esther oak to you?
No.
Think a little more carefully. Does it look like an Esther oak? Yes. So it is an estrogue, apparently, that genetically is missing the thing that holds it together. Whatever part of its DNA is supposed to hold it together as one fruit, right, is missing from that estrogue. But maybe it qualified as an estrogue. So they bring it back. Say, look, this is the best that we could do. It's actually called Buddha's hand, or God's hand. That's what it's called in that country. In that area, and they bring it back and they say, what do we do? Can we use it? Can we not use it? So luckily, there is a sefer called Shail Setshuvos Zivchei Tzedek. Shail Setshuvos Zivchei Tzedek is written by Rav Abdullah Somech, I found here. Abdullah Somech, actually, this sefer here has many shailas, that is, I found out on Shabbos, that the Abraham family sent back to him. I mean, they're living in Shanghai. He's living in Baghdad, I believe. They sent him questions, and many of those questions are what made up this sefer. So I don't know if this, but he had died way before. So it wasn't. They probably didn't send this shaila. This shaila was, what's the story with these strange-looking esrogim that seem to have 10 fingers coming out of the bottom? Right? Are those going to be usable, or are they not going to be usable? And Rav Abdullah Somech here on the bottom, you could see, actually paskin. Yes, he paskin their mutter. He thinks that you could use them on Sukkos because they're not morkav. And he says there is a Gemara that talks about esrogim that grow in a box, right? Can you mold esrogim? Like, let's say you want to have a square esrog, which will fit into your holder a little bit better. Is that mutter? Can you grow? Right, you could do that, right? You know, everybody ever seen square watermelon, right? So you could do that, right? You could do it with esrogim too. You could have it grow into a mold, right? So he said, people want to say a mold is usser, right? The Gemara doesn't allow it. He said, yeah, but this wasn't grown into mold, this was natural, right? It's the same thing, it's just looks different, but that's okay. It technically, by DNA, he claimed was the same thing and actually felt that it was mutter. However, his brother-in-law felt that it was usser. That's at the bottom of the page. His brother-in-law is none other than, you may have heard this name, the Ben Ishchai. Does that name sound familiar? His brother-in-law was the Ben Ishchai. So he records his brother's responsa here, where his brother prohibited it. His brother said that it's no good. In this book, Operation Torah Rescue, which has some of the story of the yeshiva students, there it records that some of them used it, but they didn't make a bracha on it. And in fact, this has continued until today, because not necessarily Baruch Hashem, Jews can get esrogim wherever they want, but hey, it would be pretty cool to show up with one of these guys on Sukkot and say, hey, everybody, look at my esrog. So this shaila was actually raised, and there is, people don't realize this, but in the OU, the Orthodox Union, so they have, people just think, they give hechsher, they go to plants, etc. They have volumes of responsa that were written by their poskim. Who are their poskim? So their poskim are Rabbi Menachem Gedeck, Rav Herschel Schefter, Rabbi Yisrael Belsky, when he was still alive, he's passed away. Apparently Rav Usher Weiss has also started writing things for them. So they collect all, and they actually have a tremendous amount of responses that are written. And this shaila was raised. Can we use the Buddha's hand esrogim as esrogim on Sukkos? I only put on here on the bottom the part of the tshuva where Rav Schefter wrote, he felt that he couldn't. So, sorry. If you wanted to get one of them, so you could get one of them, it would be pretty cool. It's a nice memorial to what Jews had to survive and live with when they were in Shanghai, but I wouldn't recommend using it for a mitzvah. So anyways, we should all appreciate perhaps a little bit better the opportunity that we have in this country to get what we need to get and to have really abundance to be able to do all of our mitzvahs in the best possible way. Shulad Baruch Sima Tova. Thank you for coming.